From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
My husband's on fire. Something just blew up.
There was a gas leak at your house?
Yes, ma'am, in the alley, which has been leaking. I told him to please check it. It had been fixed already.
In New York City, one man said he thought the world was coming to an end. A deafening explosion caused two apartment buildings to collapse.
Might have something going on here with overpressurization. We contacted Andover. They are having the same issue.
Somebody dropped a 500-pound bomb right on Main Street. We had 41 people who were killed. That's a lot of people killed in one small area.
Louisiana, New York, Texas, most recently Massachusetts, just a few of the deadly natural gas explosions we've witnessed over the past several decades. American infrastructure is aging everywhere, but natural gas pipelines may pose a particular threat. Underground and out of sight, the more than 70,000 miles of cracking, leaking old pipelines are easy to forget, especially when a complex patchwork of state and federal oversight makes it even harder to come up with a clear path forward on how to fix them. So this hour on Point, natural gas and America's aging infrastructure beneath our feet. And you can join us. From small leaks to major explosions, how do you judge the danger of our old natural gas pipelines? What's it going to take to fix those tens of thousands of miles of this critical infrastructure? And are you prepared to pay the cost? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me today from Washington is Gregory Corti. He's national correspondent for USA Today, and he reported a major story for the paper just this week, headlined "Pipeline Peril: Natural Gas Explosions Reveal Silent Danger Lurking in Old Cast Iron Pipes." And you can get a link to that at onpointradio.org. Gregory, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Good to be with you.
Also with us in the studio is Kira Blessing. She's a reporter for the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. She's covered the natural gas explosions that happened earlier this year in Massachusetts extensively. Kira, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, we'll have links to Kira's reporting also at onpointradio.org. But Gregory, first, let me start with you. Give us a sort of national lay of the land here. How would you describe the state of the pipeline infrastructure across the country?
Well, a lot of the infrastructure was built a century or more ago when we first sort of discovered natural gas as a cheap and abundant source of energy to heat our homes, to cook our food, to heat our water, to give us hot showers. And a lot of it, believe it or not, has not been replaced since that time. There are tens of thousands of miles of old cast iron gas mains in major American cities, especially the older industrial cities in the Northeast, but also, you know, around the country that has the older infrastructure. And it's, by and large, to a lot of people, I think, out of sight, out of mind. It's underneath the street. There's a service line that goes from that main into your home that hooks up to a meter. And as these things begin to corrode over the years, they can be extremely dangerous.
Okay, so in a minute, I'm going to talk specifically about sort of the latest disaster that occurred in Massachusetts regarding these natural gas pipelines. But Gregory, I mean, when we're talking about infrastructure across the country here, is it that we have sort of a national scale problem, or, you know, given how localized these pipelines ultimately are in that last mile, is it that we have sort of certain problem areas that, if we just focus on those, then most of the issues would fall away?
It is a problem across the country, but particularly a problem in places like Boston, New York, and the incident that we're talking about here in Massachusetts. It's particularly hard to replace those pipes because the houses are very close together, the streets paved, there may be local regulations as to how often utilities can dig up those streets. But I've even seen tragic explosions in newer subdivisions where pipelines were installed incorrectly, or where when the utility was upgrading equipment. Very often, as we saw in Massachusetts, it's when these pipelines are being upgraded. Long term, that should help the safety issue. But anytime you dig into underground and are digging around these pipes, it can get dangerous and catastrophic.
Okay, so let's talk more specifically then about this latest disaster that drew the nation's attention back to our natural gas infrastructure. It happened in September of this year in both Lawrence and Andover, Massachusetts, where natural gas explosions destroyed dozens of homes, killed a teenager, forced the evacuation of entire neighborhoods. So first of all, here's Andover, Massachusetts Police Chief Michael Mansfield describing what his city was like following these explosions.
It looked like Armageddon. It really did. There were billows of smoke coming from Lawrence behind me. I could see plumes of smoke in front of me within the town of Andover. It just looked like an absolute war zone.
Well, Kira Blessing, you're a reporter for the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. You were there on that day and covered what happened extensively. Just take us back. What was it like?
Yeah, so it was, I have to say, one of the most surreal experiences I've had. I was in the newsroom about 4 p.m. when we heard a fire come in over the scanner. Thought little of it. Fires happen all the time. Sent a reporter. Then we heard another one come in and thought, what are the odds? That's really unlucky. And then when we heard the third fire come in, we thought something must be wrong. And that's when one of our photographers who had gone to the first fire called us and said, it's gas. This is going to be a problem. And it was right after that the scanner just blew up. So I threw a web update online and got out into the field. And our newsroom sits on top of a hill that overlooks Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I pulled out of the parking lot, just as Chief Mansfield said, you could just see these plumes of black smoke just covering the city. So I went to the first fire I could find. And one of the most alarming things to see was that I beat one of the fire trucks there, first of all.
Right.
And then a lot of the firefighters I saw were having a hard time hooking up to the hydrants because so many were being tapped that there was no water pressure.
I see.
So they couldn't even fight the fires they were responding to.
I mean, ultimately, due to mutual aid agreements, we had fire and emergency crews coming from, you know, all over Massachusetts, mm-hmm. right, to mm-hmm. help in Lawrence and Andover. But how many homes were destroyed by these series of explosions?
I believe the preliminary number, I don't think it's finalized yet, even at this point. But there were about 80 fires by the end of the evening.
80.
Yes, simultaneously.
Okay. And we'll talk about the response from Columbia Gas, who's mm-hmm. the utility in charge of these natural gas pipelines. But what did they determine as the cause of it?
Ultimately, as they were replacing the cast iron pipes that Gregory just mentioned a few minutes ago to replace them with PVC, the NTSB found that they left out in their instructions to the contractor that there are critical sensors in that cast iron pipe that tell regulators within the system how much gas pressure is in that line. So when they removed the sensor, the regulators sensed that the pressure was falling and kept pumping more and more gas into the system, ultimately raising the pressure to 12 times the safe limit.
12 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that led directly to these dozens of explosions
right.
and fires. Okay. So, but to this point, and then Gregory was making it a little bit earlier, Columbia Gas has actually tried to upgrade the natural gas pipelines in the Lawrence and Andover area for some time. They were in the process of doing that. 40% of the pipelines there, is that number in the ballpark?
I think that sounds right, yeah.
Okay. So, I guess I'm wondering, you know, is this a question of the infrastructure or just a freak accident because of the error in the instructions to the workmen who were replacing that section of pipeline?
Right. So it's hard to say at this point because the NTSB doesn't have a final report. But from the preliminary report that was released, it definitely seems like this is just an error in essentially the blueprints that Columbia Gas gave to the subcontractor.
Okay. But it's a major error because here we are several months later, and I have to say, you know, we're based in New England here. It's going to snow tonight in the greater Boston area, likely snow. It's cold. Do these families, these dozens and dozens of families whose homes were destroyed, do they have natural gas back? What's the state of their homes? How are they doing?
I think that's one of the biggest issues here is that I think a lot of people think this has been resolved 2 months later, and it really hasn't. Just from the daily briefing numbers yesterday, there are about 3,500 meters that still do not have gas service restored. So that's 3,500 meters. So that doesn't perfectly equate to homes, but it's pretty close. There are 7,824 individuals currently accounted for in temporary housing.
7,000?
7,000.
Still?
Yes. And that doesn't include the people who are staying with friends and family, who didn't need to go through Columbia Gas. I mean, it's really still a huge problem in the Merrimack Valley.
And who are they getting assistance from? Who should be giving them assistance?
Well, you would hope it would be Columbia Gas. I just wrote a story last week that the main problem is that Columbia Gas has not been very communicative. There's been a lot of mixed signals, different answers coming from different people, and that's what's been frustrating people the most.
All right, Gregory, I want to loop you back in here. What are the lessons that this ongoing disaster, because clearly it's not over for the people who live in Lawrence and Andover in the Merrimack Valley in Massachusetts, what lessons should we take from that regarding the state of our natural gas infrastructure?
Yeah, the industry that represents natural gas utilities across the country says this is a game-changing incident, and they certainly expect that this will lead to a lot of changes in how they do business across the board. But at this point, it's really hard to know what those changes are going to be. There's still an active investigation from the NTSB, which Kira was talking about, the National Transportation Safety Board. We don't usually think of pipelines as transportation, but they are, and so that's why the NTSB gets involved. And they're still investigating. These investigations can take months or years. And until then, the Columbia Gas and other people involved in this are prohibited from talking about the exact causes of this. But as we know, you know, this was a mistake in the instructions given to the crews. So we're going to look at changes in how crews are trained, the replacement schedules for these pipelines, and ultimately, you know, what they're made of and how these pipelines are put together.
Yeah, and when we come back, we're going to talk about who has oversight, or that patchwork of state and federal oversight over our natural gas infrastructure. That's what we're talking about this hour. We're talking about those pipelines beneath our feet. As Gregory Cordy has told us, that many of them are very old. Obviously, a lot of them are leaking, sometimes so dangerously we have natural gas explosions. What's it going to cost, and how do we repair this? Coast to Coast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about America's aging infrastructure, but particularly the natural gas pipelines, the millions of miles of natural gas pipelines coast to coast that are running underneath our feet. Much of it is extremely aged. Much of it is old cast iron and is in need of upgrades, and sometimes in terrible, devastating circumstances. We get reminded of that with major explosions, such as we saw earlier this year in Massachusetts. And I'm joined today by Gregory Cordy. He's national correspondent for USA Today. He's written extensively about America's aging natural gas infrastructure. Kira Blessing is also with us. She's a reporter at the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. She covered the Merrimack Valley explosions that happened in September extensively here. And Gregory and Kira, I just want to explore with you for a minute this issue of who has oversight over this infrastructure. I mean, Gregory, in your piece, you described this patchwork of federal and state-level oversight. So how would you describe what that patchwork is?
Yeah, it's a legacy of how the system came into being. And every natural gas utility, all utilities really, are regulated at the state level, usually by a public utilities commission or a public utilities department in Massachusetts. You know, they have regulated these things from the beginning of time. And then in 1968, President Lyndon Johnson, in his State of the Union address, as part of the consumer protection initiatives that he was seeking in the Great Society, asked Congress to specifically pass a law for natural gas pipeline safety. Congress was reluctant, but then later that year, there was a huge explosion in Richmond, Indiana. killed 41 people. It's the worst possible incident where the natural gas fire happened next door to a gun factory. The gunpowder exploded. 41 people were killed. And that prompted Congress to get involved. But they really sort of took a half step. They didn't want to take regulation completely away from the states. So they created an Office of Pipeline Safety to sort of oversee the create some standard federal regulations, but still left it to the states to enforce them.
Okay.
And that's pretty much what we have today.
Okay. So then, Kira Blessing, how did that patchwork play out and what happened in Lawrence and Andover, Massachusetts in September?
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really interesting part of Gregory's piece because on the same day that the NTSB released their preliminary report that essentially pointed the finger at Columbia Gas, the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities released a statement that they were asking gas companies across the state to review their own safety protocols before continuing work. But that was all it said, was that they were asking the companies to review their own protocols, which I thought was kind of striking because, you know, I don't know if they're going to go and check that they've done that or if they're just going to rely on these companies to handle that themselves.
So still leaving it to the companies, the utilities, to determine for themselves, as Gregory reported.
Right. Although I do believe that Governor Baker has brought an independent investigator to oversee how the Commonwealth in particular oversees these companies.
Okay, interesting. So after that NTSB report, Kira, that you're talking about, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey made some comments about this, and he says that for all the reasons we're talking about right now, that there are still a lot of unanswered questions, and he's called for congressional hearings on this.
I have reviewed Columbia Gas's safety operations and response plans and found that the company was woefully unprepared for a disaster of this magnitude.
That's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Well, Gregory and Kira, hold on here for just a second because I want to bring in now Cynthia Quarterman. She was the top administrator of the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. She served in that post under President Obama from 2009 to 2014. She's a senior fellow with the Global Energy Center at the Atlantic Council now, and she's with us from Washington. Cynthia Quarterman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you. So describe to us, I mean, you have experience at the federal level here. Is there a gap? I mean, Gregory and Kira seem to be describing to us that there is either a gap between federal oversight and where states pick up, or are we perhaps just trusting individual utilities and companies too much to cover that gap?
I don't think there's a gap.
Okay.
There is a federal agency, the Hazardous Materials Agency that you mentioned, the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which is in the Department of Transportation, which is there because pipeline movement of oil and gas is considered transportation. That is a very, very small agency within the Department of Transportation. The pipeline safety piece of that is really only a couple of hundred people. The inspectors, they have about 200 inspectors who oversee mostly the interstate, meaning the pipelines that travel across the country, and not those like the ones in Massachusetts, which are intrastate and are pretty much covered by the states.
Right. So can I just jump in here for a second? So 200
sure.
inspectors for interstate pipelines.
Right.
For across this giant nation of ours. Are those 200 enough?
Absolutely not. There are another 300, probably close to 400 state inspectors that work for the individual states as well. So we're talking about a total of about 600 inspectors for about 2.1 million miles of pipeline, both oil and gas, around the country. So the coverage is not great. And I agree with Greg about the way the Pipeline Safety Act came into being and the current status of the existing agency. It really was a sort of bootstrap where the federal government took over what the states were doing, but they had to, as most pieces of legislation are, they had to make a compromise. And the compromise essentially was, let's not step on the states' toes who are always already doing this. And so we'll put this federal system on top of that. It is not ideal at all.
Right. Gregory, let me just turn it back to you for a quick second, because not to put too fine a point on this, but didn't you talk to someone in your reporting who had been in this industry for a long time and said that in the 25 or 30 years he'd worked in the natural gas field, he'd never once seen one of these federal inspectors because there are just so few of them?
Yeah. And then this was a guy, his name's Mark McDonald. He's based in the Boston area, used to work for Boston Gas. And he was responsible for natural gas safety. Never saw a PHMSA inspector. That's the acronym that we use for the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Never saw a PHMSA inspector in his entire career. Rarely saw a state inspector. I want to make another point here is that you do have this issue between state and federal regulation. But there's another level here in that. Since 2010, the federal regulators have sort of emphasized this self-regulating mechanism where each utility comes up with its own plan called a distribution integrity management plan to identify the own risk to its system. And that has some advantages because every system is different based on soils and geology and weather and so forth.
And who would know it better than the company managing it?
And that's a strong argument for it, but it also leaves to the utilities themselves to decide for themselves what the problems are. And the point that Senator Markey was making in that clip that you played was that the utility companies don't know what they don't know. And that was evident in the Massachusetts explosions. No plan for that. Nobody ever anticipated that an overpressurization event like that could possibly occur.
I mean, I guess one way of putting it is that there will always be that kind of black swan event. But how much, I mean, Cynthia Quarterman, on that point, how much should we be expecting these companies and utilities to know, to be prepared? I mean, there will always be that outlier event, and we don't want that to happen. But is it realistic to say that we should be expecting more of them in terms of their preparedness? And also, let me just put it this way. Should they be more aggressive in their upgrading plans for this infrastructure?
Absolutely. In the first instance, safety rests with the operators of these pipelines. And this was a situation where the company should have rigorously thought through all the steps of constructing and removing the existing pipeline and had a plan in place that would have dealt with these regulators that were in the pipeline. I mean, that is their responsibility. There are two series of regulations here. One of sort of the old-fashioned prescriptive regs that say, you do this, you meet this requirement, and you've met the legal requirement. And then there is the integrity management system, which is the one that Greg was talking about, which is one where essentially you say to the regulated entity, okay, you know this system better, figure out what the risks are, and not just doing the prescriptive things that we can all think of, but go that extra step. Mm. Figure out where people are along your pipeline. Figure out what the risks are at that point and address them throughout your system, which I think can be a very strong standard as well. But companies need to step up and do that.
Right. Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Newark, Ohio. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. My point is that there's no maintenance anymore. We have gutted and gone to contractors, and contractors are fine, but they might be from out of state. They don't have a sense of ownership with where they're at. And so then if they would listen to good, experienced maintenance personnel, then there would be a continuity. It would be a wealth of knowledge for them. And we just want to contract and go with engineers and don't have good maintenance.
Okay, so Joe, let me just ask you quickly, do you have sort of a personal experience with this? And you're sounding like you're coming from the position of someone who might know.
I do. I've worked in maintenance my whole life, and maintenance is always kind of a bygone. New construction is always favored. But your maintenance personnel, if a good engineer is listening to who's out in the field, they can go back and forth, and if you had a man who, the staff that had worked for years, they might have been able to alert somebody with a problem. You can't do that. I don't care what kind of degree. You're a 25-year-old whiz kid from an engineering school, but you made a mistake.
Right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Will, who's calling from Piermont, New Hampshire. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention there's another issue which applies to propane, which is in a lot of rural homes, and the piping that's used in the home, which is a fairly new development called CSST, it's corrugated stainless steel tubing, and it explodes during thunderstorms. And the previous methods of black iron and copper did not have that problem. And this has been going on for 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lightning-resistant version, but that has failed also.
Yeah. Well, Will, thank you so much for your call. Kira Blessing, let me turn back to you here because, again, what happened in Massachusetts is our latest example of what can go terribly wrong when we don't adequately look after our natural gas infrastructure. But tell us in a little bit more detail, what steps has Columbia Gas taken following these explosions? I mean, you were telling me earlier that residents, the 7,000 people who are still displaced, don't feel as if Columbia Gas has done enough. I mean, what more have they done?
Right. So immediately after this, they announced that they were going to be replacing all 45 miles of affected pipeline immediately, which they had had a plan in place to do that over the course of, I don't know, maybe a decade or so. So first they announced they were going to replace all of that immediately with PVC piping. They said that they completed that work about a week or two ago.
Okay.
Ahead of schedule. The problem is that even though that main pipeline has been replaced and is ready to go, there are so many issues in the individual homes. So not only the pipelines leading up to the individual homes, the individual meters, but every single appliance in the home needs to be inspected and replaced. And because every home is different, every home has a different heating system, every home has, you know, preferences of the homeowners, et cetera, it's been very difficult to streamline that process. But that is leading to confusion. People have told me that they're told Columbia Gas is coming in the next 72 hours and then they never show up. They've told me that they had no idea Columbia Gas was coming and they show up at their doorstep, that they have to come five different times just to fix a stove. I mean, it's been very, very confusing.
Has Columbia Gas committed to bearing the burden of the cost of all of this?
They have. And according to their quarter three financial filings, they are insured for up to $800 million. And I think they project the cost to be about $860 million or so.
Okay. Well, Gregory Corti, let me turn back to you here because we've got a comment on our website coming in from Ian D, who's asking, please discuss how the failures in our infrastructure are the result of a corporate mindset that promotes returning profits to shareholders over reinvesting in infrastructure. Why should the government and taxpayers be put on the hook for the failure of private companies to maintain what is essentially their property? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and it's really how this whole system is set up. That these are run by local utilities. In some places, it's actually they're city owned, especially in the South. Or Memphis is probably the biggest one that has a municipally owned local gas utility. Philadelphia is another one I should mention. They're largely, though, investor-owned utilities. And the premise of a utility and why investors like them so much is that, you know, they have dependable returns. They pay good dividends. They're not a big growth stock, but, you know, if you're on a fixed income, they provide a steady stream of income. And that's because of this sort of deal that's made with state regulators that says, you know, here's how much you have to run your system. Here's how much profit you can expect. And interestingly, there's a Supreme Court precedent from, I think, the 1930s that says that the lost gas, there's a certain percentage of lost and unaccounted for gas that goes through leaks. Some of those leaks are hazardous, which we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of smaller leaks that in the system that can cause gas to disseminate into the atmosphere. And the cost of that lost gas is charged back to the customer, whether they get that gas or not. So there's not always incentive by these utilities to fix all of these leaks, at least from an economic standpoint, because they can write off the cost of that lost gas.
All right. Well, Cynthia Quarterman, we've just got a minute to go here before the break, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, one thing I forgot to point out earlier is in 2011, there was a big incident in Allentown, Pennsylvania, similar to the one in Lawrenceville, related to cast iron pipes. The cause was entirely different. And shortly thereafter, the department and I came together and said, we need to repair, rehabilitate, or replace the highest risk pipelines out there.
Right.
And prioritize cast iron pipeline and some bare iron pipeline. Since that time, we have seen the amount of main service lines that are cast iron go out of use. But we're still far, far away from where we need to be. There's still about 7,000 miles of pipeline.
Okay, so we're gonna talk a little bit more about that when we come back. You're listening to Cynthia Quarterman. She was the top administrator of the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration from 2009 to 2014. Kira Blessing is also with us. She's a reporter at the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. And Gregory Corti is with us as well. He's a national correspondent for USA Today. And we're talking about America's aging infrastructure, but specifically those thousands of miles of natural gas pipeline running beneath our feet. Oftentimes out of sight, out of mind, until something terrible happens with a natural gas explosion. So what do we need to do to fix this? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about America's aging infrastructure, but specifically about our natural gas pipeline infrastructure beneath our feet. And I'm joined today by Gregory Corti. He's national correspondent for USA Today. He's written extensively about this issue. His story this week was headlined, Pipeline Peril, Natural Gas Explosions Reveal Silent Danger Lurking in Old Cast Iron Pipes. Kira Blessing is also with us. She's a reporter at the Lawrence Eagle Tribune in Massachusetts, where in September of this year in the Merrimack Valley, we had a series of dozens of homes exploding into fireballs due to a major natural gas failure there. Cynthia Quarterman is also with us. She was the top administrator for the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration from 2009 to 2014. And just to let you all know, we've got a lot of comments coming in here online. Katie is saying on our website, isn't this just another example to invest in up-and-coming technology instead of aging and crumbling infrastructure that was designed for a different America? History is littered with the remains of abandoned infrastructure. And Joe M. Cogswell Jr. Says, call me out for preaching to the choir, but it seems reasonably clear to abandon further development of natural gas infrastructure and divert those investments into wind, solar, and hydropower. And I want to bring in one more quick voice into this conversation. Christina Sames joins us now from Houston, Texas. She's vice president of the American Gas Association, the trade organization that represents more than 200 natural gas companies across America. Christina Sames, welcome to you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So earlier this hour, Gregory was saying that he had spoken to a representative of the industry who said that the explosions in Massachusetts Merrimack Valley were a game-changing incident, and that was you who said that. So how exactly is the industry going to change or wants to change following what happened in Lawrence and Andover?
Well, just to give you an idea of how seriously we take these types of incidents. Immediately following the incident in Massachusetts, we pulled all the companies together for a conference call to explain what had occurred, everything we knew from the NTSB, from public officials, so that they were aware. We then immediately put out a survey asking every company to tell us everything they could possibly think of to prevent overpressurization from occurring. That led to a rough document. We pulled in over 200 individual subject matter experts just a few weeks ago to say, here's what we received so far. What else is missing? From that, the reason I'm actually in Houston today is we have over 30 companies in another room that are helping us to identify leading practices. Out of everything that we've received, what are the leading practices to prevent overpressurization? And there are a couple areas that we're focused on. We're focused on what I call the people elements, things like training and processes and procedures, but also the equipment portion, items that, the hard wires that can help prevent overpressurization. Mm-hmm. We'll have that document complete and available to the public within the next 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, Christina, stand by here for just a second, because this seems like a good first step. I want to get to Cynthia Quarterman's view on this. I mean, again, she was the top administrator for the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Cynthia, does this sound like a positive first step from the natural gas industry?
Well, it certainly does sound like a positive first step, but we have to get beyond the first step and actually get to a point where we can prevent these overpressurizations from reoccurring, whether it's some sort of a safety valve or a stop so that the pipeline system will know never to put 12 times as much gas into a pipeline than it can actually handle.
So, Cynthia, if I may, is that another way of saying there are things that we know we can do right now that aren't or haven't been done?
I'm going to let Christina answer that question. I think there might be ways to do that already. I mean, some of these systems are quite old, as we discussed. Yeah. I mean, we have pipelines in the ground from the 1800s still, and the systems that are operating those are not up to, 2001 standards. It's just not.
Okay. So, Christina, same respond to that then. I mean, I guess respond to my question, which is, are there things that we know we could do right now that don't necessarily need to wait for this, positive first step, but a documentation of new best practices?
Yeah. And so the reason why we wanted to create the document first is we wanted to make sure that we had what truly are the leading practices for companies to adopt. Every system's unique, which means that there is not a silver bullet that you can say across the board every company should do X, Y, Z. What we need is a variety of leading practices that companies can adopt based on their unique system. So what you'll see when the document's public is a variety of tools for operators to choose from. Our expectation is many of those are already in place. However, we don't want an incident like this to ever occur again. So whether it be relooking at additional equipment on the system, additional human or processes and procedures, what else needs to be done? Mm-hmm. Because it's in nobody's interest to have an incident like this occur.
Christina, if I may just ask you, because we were talking about this a little earlier in the show, and I'd love to get your perspective on it, that utilities find themselves in kind of an interesting situation because they are serving the public with key infrastructure that we all need, but many of them are also shareholder-owned. I mean, is there a tension there that may prevent or at least dissuade utilities from acting with in the most speedy and comprehensive way possible to upgrade all of this critical infrastructure? Because I've got a comment here from our website, Joss Trends, is saying, as long as the terms maintenance and preventative maintenance are looked upon as costs, we have no chance.
So maybe I can, and I apologize if this was covered earlier in the show, but maybe I can just walk through pipe replacement. I'm at a really high level. So there's multiple. First, pipe replacement is for distribution lines has to be approved by the state commissioners. The state commissioners balance safety and cost to customers, and there's, it's a fine line. You want to make sure you're as safe as possible, and you're replacing the lines that are in need of replacement. that may have reached their life cycle with the cost to the customer. So that's the first stop. How many miles of pipe has the state said can be replaced? From that, you also have to make sure, and what they're looking at is, you know, how many qualified individuals does the company have to do this work? What's the public's tolerance for disruption? Because when you replace pipe, you're digging up yards, you're digging up streets, mm-hmm. and that causes disruption. It also increases the cost to the customer. So all of that has to be balanced. If you try to do it all at once, customers' bills dramatically go up, many streets are torn up, and usually that's not something that the public likes. So what you'll see companies doing is replacing as much as they possibly can. It may have been mentioned that Secretary LaHood, from the former Secretary of Transportation, really partnered with the industry to get states to embrace faster replacement. PHMSA has a great website of where there's still cast iron and bare steel lines. And what you'll see is it took a little bit longer for some states to embrace.
Yeah.
Now we're doing our best to get that out of the ground.
Well, Christina Sames, a vice president of the American Gas Association, a trade organization that represents more than 200 natural gas supply companies, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're quite welcome.
Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let me just let them in here for a second. Jeff is calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for taking my call.
No problem. How? First of all, was your home affected in these Merrimack Valley explosions earlier this year?
Yes, it was. Fortunately, we didn't have a fire, but we ended up losing all our gas appliances that had to be ended up being replaced.
Okay, and so what's your thought today, several months later?
I guess just if any executives out there are listening, it would probably be a lot cheaper to replace lines ahead of time than to have to replace everyone's gas appliances. I mean, it was thousands of dollars that, you know, Columbia Gas has reimbursed us. You know, it's the one thing they've done very well. I would say they're on top of that, but you know, it would be cheaper in the long run to get it done before an accident.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your call. Gregory Corti, let me turn back to you. You've been listening along here patiently, and I appreciate that very much. But what did you hear from Christina Sames there? I mean, it sounds like they're working hard to get a document out for a new set of like best practices in the industry. But there are also still immediate needs and things that could be done, which I heard her try to answer by talking us through the complexities that come along with even just laying down new pipelines. And just your thoughts on that, since you've been reporting on all this for some time.
Absolutely. And the irony is that Columbia Gas was in the process of trying to replace some of this dangerous old pipe when the most dangerous thing that possibly could have happened happened. Anytime you dig up these streets and start to work with these pipes, there's a danger there. But Christine was absolutely correct. I mean, there are a lot of pressures that we're hearing from some of your callers and some of the messages you've gotten, you know, that this is, you know, these are investor-owned utilities, and why don't they pay for it? Well, ultimately, you're paying for it as a consumer. And so there's been a culture in many states where they have an office of consumer advocate whose job it is to go to the Public Utilities Commission and say, we can't, you know, people on a fixed income can't really afford the increased rates that would come with this pipeline replacement plan. I think now with the Massachusetts incident, I think there's some national attention to this. Utilities are going to have to be a little bit more creative in terms of how they finance these replacement plans. But as Joe from Newark, Ohio was talking an earlier caller, you know, there's a labor issue here too, and so utilities very often contract this work out because it's cheaper to do it that way.
Yeah.
And who knows? We don't know yet what the final verdict is, but that may have also been a factor in what happened in Massachusetts.
Well, Keir Blessing, I'm thinking of all those people still in the Merrimack Valley who are probably saying, "So what?" I mean, how many of these, this scale of explosions do we have to have before ratepayers are willing to pay more, before states are willing to step up to accelerate the permitting or whatever needs to be done to lay down these new thousands of miles of pipeline? I mean, Cynthia Quarterman was telling us that there's still many thousands of even mains that need to be replaced. It seems like I get the level of complication in the overlapping areas of responsibility, but how much can the system tolerate before we just need to do what needs to be done?
Right. I mean, yeah, I think one of the things that probably has been most underreported given this around this particular incident is the psychological impact it's had on all of these people who definitely are thinking, well, so what? Lionel Rondon died. A woman, Shakira Figueroa, was severely injured and is now suing Columbia Gas. Not to mention, you know, dozens of other people who are hurt. You know, just hundreds of properties that were destroyed. And the ultimate cost of this is, you know, enormous. So yeah, I'm not sure what the answer is because I understand all those complexities. But obviously, if something as simple as the blueprint for how to do a replacement is this incorrect to cause an issue of this magnitude, then something has to change.
Well, then hopefully what Christina Sames was telling us about the new documentation they're trying to come out with it dealing with these kinds of issues might at least get us a few steps down the road to improvements there. Let me sneak in one last call here. Kevin is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. You're on the air, Kevin.
Yes, hi. I was calling to comment on the seemingly long time lag between when an incident happens somewhere, such as San Bruno, Congress and DOT issue some mandate for change, and they pass it on to PHMSA for taking action. And then PHMSA seems like this is the cycle where PHMSA will float some ideas on impending regulation, and then the industry is given just forever, it seems like, to respond, to counter, and to inevitably resist. So it just seems like PHMSA is not very responsive to the need for change.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your call. And Cynthia Quarterman, let me turn back to you here. I want to just add to Kevin's thought with a quote from Gregory's story, where he's quoting Senator Ed Markey as saying, what industries attempt to accomplish is to create a regulatory black hole where neither federal or state regulators have clear supervisory responsibility. And that's what's happening here. And that Senator Markey says going forward, we just can't let pipeline companies regulate themselves. What do you think?
Oh, I certainly agree with that. And I also agree with your caller about the amount of time it takes to get a rule from being written into the books. It was a personal frustration of mine as the head of the administration there. There is one point that I think everybody needs to think about here in terms of resources. Two points, actually.
We just have about 30 seconds, though, Cynthia.
Okay. The point is this. In order to put out a new rule, you have to have proof that it will benefit the people as much as it will cost. The cost of some of these rules are in the billions of dollars. And although these incidents are horrible, the way the government works, you cannot come up with enough benefit to offset the cost, unfortunately. And it often takes a long time to get things done.
Interesting. Well, Cynthia Quarterman, she was the top administrator of the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration from 2009 to 2014. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Kira Blessing, reporter at the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, thank you so much for being with us in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
And Gregory Corti, national correspondent for USA Today. His big story on this pipeline peril, natural gas explosions reveal silent danger lurking in old cast iron pipes. Have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Gregory, thank you so very much for your reporting and for being with us on the program.
Thanks for having me on, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.